the price of printer ink now and the big online app industry trying to make us better people. People as good and as busy as Harry. Joining us is our tech correspondent, Helen Baxter from Mohawk Media. Good morning, Helen.
Good morning, Jeff.
Nice to talk to you. The BBC reports on the problem with printer ink. And consumer may have done this here, but I couldn't easily establish that. More expensive than champagne, Helen, apparently.
Yes, per milliliter, one of the most expensive liquids in the world. More expensive than champagne, caviar, French perfume, and apparently human blood.
Really?
Yes.
The consumer watchdog in the UK found that non-branded ink cartridges perform as well or better than their branded alternatives. Now, I don't know about you, but I've found that the cheaper alternatives don't always work well or for long. And with one brand, my printer didn't like them. So, how about you? What have you found?
We've happily used third-party ink cartridges and refills previously, and this is the same model as the razor and blades model, where the printers are sold for below cost and the profit's in the ink. So the cost to make, I found an interesting stat here. The cost to make is about 23 cents, but they sell them for around $60. So you can see the huge profits that are there. But yes, the recent Which? Survey found that the reality is that many printers work perfectly well with third-party inks. In fact, they did a recent customer satisfaction survey, and the top 16 spots out of 26 brands were third-party inks. And you can save hundreds of dollars a year if you use third party. So yeah, we've happily used them in the previous. Also cartridge refill kits, which can be a bit messy and you need to do them carefully, and it can invalidate warranty, because obviously they don't want you doing this. But in order of cost per print, the most expensive are inkjets, and the ink is just dye and water. Then you've got laser printers, which are more common in offices. They use powder. And some of them are ink tank printers that actually come with refillable ink tanks if you print a lot, but they cost a lot more upfront. And one of the other things is, quite often when you buy a cheap printer and it comes with ink cartridges, they're not actually full, they're partially full. Other issues I've found is they can stop printing when one colour runs out, which can be really frustrating if a colour's out and you just need to print in black. Some of them, yes, they do use chips as security to prevent the use. And good tip is that they need running regularly as the heads can dry out. Some tips that I would say: before you buy a cheap printer, do some research. Have a look to see whether or not you can use third-party inks. Factor in the running costs, because they may seem very cheap to begin with, but over time, you're obviously paying out a lot for the refills. Look out for inkjet printers that only have two ink cartridges. So most of them come with four, which is cyan, magenta, and yellow, which is the colours, and then black. But some of them only come with two, black and tricolour. And what happens is, when that colour runs out, you have to replace the whole cartridge. But probably the best two tips I can give are, if you're just running off prints for text, print in grayscale, because that will save your colour for when you need it. And it forces the printer to use black ink, not a mix of colours, as some of them do. And also, keep your printer switched off. Only turn it on when you need to use it. And do your printing in batches, because every time you turn it on, it runs a print clean cycle, which also uses ink.
And maybe I've got too cheap a printer, which I'm now concluding from what you've said. That cost differential between, price of production and price of retail is huge, isn't it? I didn't know it was that astounding. That's incredible.
It's astronomical when you think what it actually consists of.
Now, we get offered lots of time-saving apps and software. This is the long question, Helen. We get offered lots of time-saving apps and software now to help us cope. But a big report in Wired magazine suggests that even with a glut of tools, we almost never master our tasks. Human nature being what it is, 40% of to-do items in one survey were never done. And people like writing things down so they can check them off, and that's me. Is this piece right? Do you think productivity apps have evidently become huge business, but they're basically just adding a layer of complexity to our usual unfinished business?
I think so. I mean, I've tried a lot over the years, and also I used to review a lot of digital tools, and I've ended up just coming down to using three for managing work and life. There's no one size fits all solution. And I think the most important tool really is a pen and paper, just to jot things down, to get it out of your head, because the human mind can only hold 3 to 4 things at once. And your working memory is a bit like a small whiteboard that needs to get wiped out before you have a new task in it. And also turning off alerts or the ping of distraction, I think, is really, really important. I use Trello, which is a card-based system for life tasks, and especially reusable lists like food shopping, for example. You don't need to remember what you need to stock up. So we've got a card with everything on it. We check it off. Next time we go and do a shop, we uncheck the things we need. So that means I don't have to think again about what we might need. And then I really like a tool called ClickUp for work projects, because it's flexible and it fits around the type of project that we need to do. But there's also some psychology that is quite useful to know. So one of the key things is the Zagarnik effect, or what I call it, I've started, so I'll finish. So this was a Soviet psychologist who found that when a task isn't finished, you can't stop thinking about it. A, that's partly what leads to the stress, but also it's what helps us stay focused on what's important, because if it keeps popping up in your head, it probably is something you need to do. Rather than just writing down something you need to do, but if you write a plan for how you will finish it, that really helps. And I've also read that this is the same thing for goals. So if you're setting goals, instead of just stating a goal, I will do this, if you actually write it down and say, how will I do this, you're actually getting your brain to think about the plan of action rather than just a to-do. And also another tip is avoid talking about what you're going to do, because it can trick your brain into feeling like you've already done it. So maybe all those meetings we have where we get together and say, hey, I'm going to be doing this, maybe they're not the best use of time. But they have shown that studies that people who do write things down and do make to-do lists procrastinate less and fall asleep faster. So that's really useful to know. And there's another interesting sort of psychological effect is we find it very difficult in the present to think about us in the future. So also thinking about, and I talk about this sometimes, I think, you know, what can I do today that can help future me? You know, what can you do now to help yourself now and later? But there's another point about procrastinating. It can actually be useful for creativity. And I always think about Sherlock Holmes. When he had a particularly difficult case, he used to go to an art gallery or the theatre, go and do something completely different. And one of the fun things, I was chatting to a friend about this recently, who also works from a home-based studio like we all do. And we called it procrastinating. So where you go off and you do something around the house, which is manual, that just gets you away from the screen and just lets your head kind of daydream and free float. And quite often that can really help you solve problems. But probably one of the best advice from, people who work in this space is the idea of time blocking. So rather than making a list, you actually book time into your diary for these tasks. And the other thing I recommend is batching tasks together, because one of the other things that can lead to kind of mental fatigue is switching from one sort of task to a different one. So, you know, if you need to do a lot of planning, do that in the same time frame. If you need to go and do a lot of numbers or finance, if you're doing creative writing, try to block those tasks into the same chunks of time. there is another interesting one, thinking about whether or not you run a maker's or a manager's schedule. So this comes from a blog post by Paul Graham at Y Combinator, which is a very, very successful venture capital company, which has launched a lot of successful businesses. And makers generally need longer chunks of flow time. So creative writing or coding or any kind of sort of, you know, making, you usually need to work in chunks of maybe 2 to 3 hours, whereas managers generally work in chunks of an hour at a time. And this is where you sometimes get clashes in offices with people who work in meetings predominantly. They have an hour, they may have a little break, and then they've got another hour. But to a maker, a one-hour meeting sometimes means they've lost half a day.
There's a lot of information there. Procrastinator cleaning, I like that idea. That's very tempting. I'm a terrible task switcher, so that's something I'm... It's interesting, the idea of meeting your future self, isn't it? I found that quite entrancing as you were talking about it, because you can envision yourself in, I don't know, even 2, 3, 4 years and think, how do I best achieve what I look at myself in the future and see myself as being then? That's quite a good idea.
It's quite powerful, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. All right, thank you for all that. There are people who scorn lists, but I did read that if you write down your to-dos in some shape or form, it apparently makes you less jittery. And just finally, what's unpaywall, please?
I found this via openculture.com, which is a very good site to go to if you're looking for the best free cultural and educational media on the web. But unpaywall.org it's a legal browser extension, and it allows you to read millions of peer-reviewed scientific articles without the paywall. Because one of the issues is there's a lot of taxpayer-funded scientific information, which when it gets published behind paywalls, which I don't agree with. You know, you actually have to pay to access science, which you've probably paid for. But it's legal. They harvest content from universities and scholarly societies and open content. And so if you love your science and you want to read around great content, then check it out.
That's a good tip, because a lot of those science sites, not all, but a lot of them are paywalled. Always nice to chat. Helen Baxter, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.